Welcome to episode 447. Do you have any mental health stuff going on? Some depression, anxiety, lots of savage thoughts about yourself, or even trauma or violence in your past? The mental health crisis in the USA and the Western world in general is enormous, and there are massive amounts of antidepressants and psychiatric meds that are prescribed every single day. And I thought this was highly concerning, but is it? Or is it just medicine doing its job in the best way that it can? On today's show, we talk with a pioneer of nutritional psychiatry about the direction of the mental health crisis. And as part of that, we talk on modern masculinity, how taking SSRIs and antidepressants can be a part of the feminist movement. We talk about his own mental health and also how nutrition has a direct correlation to mental resilience and mental fitness. If you want to feel better about your relationship, your work, your life, or you, then this here is for you. So let's get into it.
Welcome to the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. You've tuned in because you want to start taking your health seriously so you don't, well, get sick and die. Here we talk all things health, nutrition, and human optimization. Let's jump into it with your host and resident scientist, Maddie Lansdowne.
What's up, my healthy friends? Welcome back to the show. It feels like a minute since I was here, even though episodes for you keep coming out every week, but I'm back in the chair because this year, it's my mission to support 500 people to achieve real weight loss. And by real, I mean dealing with what's really weighing you down and not just the number on the scale. The links to chat with me or my team about our programs and to see if you can jump on the waiting list to work with us, they're down in the show notes below or the caption below. So just scroll down, click the link and start a conversation. See if we can help you. Okay, today's guest, whom I'm eager to chat with. So we've got Dr. Drew Ramsey. He's an MD, he's a board-certified psychiatrist, a psychotherapist, and an author of many fantastic brain books. His work focuses on evidence-based integrative psychiatry, nutritional psychiatry, and male mental health. He founded the Brain Food Clinic, which is a digital mental health practice, and Spruce Mental Health in Jackson, Wyoming, in the USA. Drew, welcome to the show, mate.
Maddie, everybody listening, great to be with you.
Yeah, I'm excited to have this conversation. I was just listening to you on Mark Hyman's podcast just before. And have you guys known each other for a long time? Because you sound like mates from way back.
Well, we've known each other for a bit. You know, Mark was one of the really early people who was writing and thinking about food as medicine and pushing that movement in the United States. And so he kind of met me early in my career and was just encouraging. And so I think that some of the enthusiasm you see is from that. We've had a couple little projects we've done together, more so before he got really big. But yeah, I think sometimes when you're sitting with people and they're encouraging, and also he's just really great at speaking and messaging in a way that people find very compelling. So I think you're definitely picking up on something.
Yeah, he's a fantastic communicator. But what led you to explore that connection between food and mental health? Because in my experience, like mainstream psychiatry is more focused on that pharmaceutical intervention. And personally, and I often say this whenever we have a psychiatrist on the show, and I've worked in hospitals for years as well myself, when I hear psychiatrists, I kind of get like this defensive energy because I'm like, oh no, someone that's just going to medicate the problem. So what did you do to get to this place of like food and mental health being so important?
Well, I think in part, and I appreciate you sharing that reaction, but in part it's because of that, in the sense that psychiatry, when we think about medicines, we think about molecules and things that change our brain, change how we feel, you know, people get a little defensive, but all of my work, that's how I think about it, whether I'm prescribing Prozac for you or working with you to think, you know, is that the right choice? Or whether we're talking about food, it's really a collaborative effort to try and shape chemistry at the end of the day. There's a lot of debate right now about like, is there a chemical imbalance? And a lot of sound bites, to be honest, Maddie, I don't like. Well, you know, it's no one has a Prozac deficiency. And, you know, just in some ways, ideas that I don't find very helpful for mental health. And what's helpful for mental health is when we see, hey, there's a new set of science, new set of ideas that are very relevant. Everybody, conventional wellness, like no matter where you are on the healthcare political spectrum, we all know inflammation is important. We all know the microbiome is important. We all know that neuroplasticity is important. And so I think, you know, good psychopharmacology, when psychiatrists are prescribing in a well-informed way, when we're given time, as a lot of us are, you can be very responsible and very effective with medications. I think where there's a lot of frustration is because of just a massive amount, I would say, one, of misinformation. And then just, you know, that defensive vibe you talk about is because people have had a lot of bad experiences. You know, if someone meets you and they say, oh, that's for sure depression, you should take this or take that, a lot of people find that off-putting. And so, but, you know, it's my hope that each one of these tenets of mental health, as I've kind of moved from really, like, food interests me always. In part, I'm a farm boy from Indiana. I was a vegetarian when I was younger. I was a student athlete, loved thinking about nutrition and really trying to, like, do my best to feed my brain, feed my body. You know, all that said, I found I really kind of struggled on that diet with energy. I really struggled to, in some ways, you know, eat a well-rounded diet. And then as I trained as a psychiatrist at Columbia in New York City, a few things struck me. One, a lot of data was coming out about the omega-3 fats. I didn't eat those. And I'm the kind of person that I think in some ways I have a great faith in our bodies and our ability to be healthy through our efforts. And so it just struck me, to have optimal mental health, if you need to eat omega-3 fats, I needed to learn how to eat seafood, something I really kind of didn't like. And in doing that, they got into a nutritional psychiatry. It wasn't really called that in any way then. I'm one of the sort of very first. Australia is actually really has a very deep bench of nutritional psychiatry and nutritional psychiatry research, as I'm sure as you and probably everyone listening in Australia knows. I hope you all know about the Mood and Food Academy and Felice Jacka and Wolfgang Marx, and there's great work in nutritional psychiatry. But there's, when I started training, there just wasn't any of that. And there still isn't in a lot of training places. So the idea, for example, we all know magnesium, very important, very helpful, very underconsumed, but we don't know where to get magnesium in food, most of us. And most physicians don't know where to, you know, which foods to recommend for that. It's, I didn't. And it just kind of, that happened over and over again. We all thought omega-3 fats were interesting for depression, maybe helpful for patients with mental health disorders, but we didn't ask people how much seafood they would eat. And so the idea that, you know, you're eating a lot of tilapia, you're really not getting any omega-3 fats. If shrimp is your main seafood, same thing. If you eat a tin of anchovies or sardines a few times a week, you're getting more omega-3 fats than just about anybody. So there's a way that the nuanced history taking about, you know, where do we get these important nutrients just kind of struck me when we weren't asking. And then as clinicians, we didn't really know. And so I think that's kind of the early for me, some of the origins of my interest in food and mental health. And then I like food. I like to cook. And I found, sorry to go on and on here, Maddie, the last part is I liked what it did for the clinical conversation. Because a lot of clinical conversation with your psychiatrist, you know, I do a 75 to 90 minute evaluation. And there's a lot of questions you need to ask. There's a lot of information you're trying to get. And a lot of it's very hard about trauma, past depressive episodes, you know, treatments gone wrong, treatments gone right. People have very complex psychiatric histories. It's sometimes a little traumatizing just to kind of go over it. They've met a lot of clinicians and, you know, had a lot of labels, a lot of diagnoses attached to them. So just this notion that now we're going to talk about, like, hey, can we talk a little about, like, your food, what you, not just, like, in that medical way, stop eating the good stuff, but in, like, hey, what do you like? How do you feel that food relates to your mental health? Can you tell me a little bit about yourself as an eater? Where do you like to shop? What are some of your favorite meals? What's your favorite restaurant? What do you like to cook at home? What kind of snacks do you like? How do you prep and organize and think about food? This wasn't thought of as a mental health conversation, but everybody listening, you can all agree, like, those are all really important parts of mental health. When I meet somebody as a psychiatrist and someone is very intentional about their food, have a clear set of food values, are, you know, probably cooking or eating a fair amount at home, as we know that's indicated, that's correlated with all sorts of mental health benefits. You know, that's different than somebody who's feels overwhelmed, you know, going from one piece of misinformation to the next, you know, not ever going to the grocery store, living on, you know, kind of one processed food meal to the next. I think we've all been in some version of that, whether we're traveling or too busy, or we're in finals, but we just, you know, I think all can attest to that doesn't leave us feeling our best.
There's so many things in what you just said that I want to, like, pull on. So I'm going to try and not make this a 10-hour conversation, but
I'll try and give shorter answers, everybody. Sorry, I've been working all day and this is my first break, so it's fun to talk a little bit.
Don't stress. You can talk as much as you like. That's the brilliant thing about podcast formats. They can go as long as we need. But it's interesting too when, I guess, you talk about the conversations that you have from a clinical perspective, because I think most people think of psychotherapists or psychiatrists as divulging complicated trauma and feelings that I don't even really know or understand. So I'm curious, with this shift to talking about food, does that open the door to, I guess, a more practically applicable approach to healing oneself or healing the patient, as opposed to saying, we have to deep dive on this conversation for the next 4 years before we can peel back enough layers to be effective?
I think about it as the same conversation. I think you're speaking to a way that as I practice, and also this is, nutritional psychiatry led into mental fitness. And so healing the modern brain is really kind of all about this, which is, you're asking a little bit like we think about mental health as like, oh, I've got to go in and something wrong with me, the doc's going to know maybe, or some deep thing in my past. And, certainly sometimes that happens. But a lot of times it's people have psychiatric concerns or mental health symptoms, and they just haven't been properly diagnosed or explained. This happened to me. I had kind of a panic attack the other night, and it took me like a day and a half. I looked at my wife. I was like, man, that impending doom symptom? I had that but in the midst of it, I was like, oh, so uncomfortable. I'll just say that, our mental health is evolving, and that notion you have of actionable things, that's what I've called mental fitness. Things that we all can do in our everyday life. You can make lentils tonight. Everybody can. Lentils are inexpensive. We can all afford lentils. They're easily available. They're very easy to cook. They're delicious. And a cup of lentils has 70% of your daily need of folate, vitamin B9. It has about, 68% of your daily need of fiber. It has 18 grams of protein. And on and on, lots of phytonutrients. This idea that there are actionable things that we can all do a little bit better job of. I call these the nine tenets of mental fitness. And food is the one that kind of led me into it. Then as I looked around, there's just a lot of other things that we weren't really asking people about in the clinical setting. We take a social history in medicine and psychiatry, which is about sort of alcohol, drugs, but there's not a lot about like socializing, I realize. There's not like, hey, tell me about your friends. You have a best friend. Tell me about relationships. We ask a lot about relationships, but again, as you said, it's not what people expect in psychiatry and in psychotherapy and psychology. Really, all of my colleagues are the big mental health family of clinicians. Mm-hmm. So, the idea of actionable things. When I say they're together, I find that when we're taking action, taking care of our mental fitness, we're in more of a state where we can make use of treatment. I mean, everybody can imagine this. Just imagine you're in my shoes, got someone come in, they've got a clear, panic disorder or depression. They're in the midst of it. They're interested in trying a medicine. Maybe they've been in therapy for a while. Okay. Prescribe a medicine. If that person is moving their body and eating well and abstaining from alcohol and pushing through and building their connections, really thinking about these tenets of mental fitness, I think we can all agree they're more likely to get better. If the medicine is going to work in both of these scenarios, it's more likely to work and have sort of more optimal effects when an individual is also really working their mental fitness. And so part of this book was really trying to map out for people who don't have any kind of formal mental health diagnosis. I really wanted to speak to just the general population, because I think all of us struggle with different aspects of our mental health, different symptoms at different times in our lives. And I think what we need to normalize is the seeking to take better care of that part of the self, that if you struggle with anxiety and depression, not to live in isolation or shame, but to get very active. And if you don't really meet criteria, whether you have depression or not, or whether you have alcohol use disorder or not, I'm in private practice. I wouldn't say I don't care, but what matters to me is whether you get better or not. If you have one symptom of depression, right, you also have this 5 out of 9 criteria, right? What gets you the diagnosis? And people worried. If you have 2 symptoms, let's get to work.
I'm curious, off the back of the phrase that you might have heard before, a builder's house is never fixed. I want to ask you, because you just honestly and vulnerably shared that you had a panic attack, you know?
Yeah, I was like a surprise, man.
Yeah, my question to you is, are you okay? How's your mental fitness?
Oh, thanks, Maddie. My mental fitness is doing pretty well. I appreciate that. I mean, yeah. I've had a big transition over the last like 4 years. I moved, which is, everybody knows, you know, a big mental health stress. You know, I'm a public-ish figure talking about mental health. So I think that comes with a lot of challenge these days, just a lot of ways people are sharing, a lot of ways that I get maybe like triggered and activated. I get very like protective of patients and of some of how we think about mental health. It's just always been important to me to try and help create a world where there's more treatment, less stigma, more awareness. Mm-hmm. I would say that in terms of some parts of my mental health, probably better than ever. I stopped drinking like 3.5 years ago. I never had like a massive problem with alcohol, but other than I liked it a lot, and I'm a little less fun now. But I think that in terms of my sort of, I guess how you're asking, like, you know, like how to, people ask, like, how do I rate my mental fitness? You can kind of hear how I go about it, where I think about some of the aspects that I'm doing well or specific areas that I've improved. I'm looking around for my journal to show everyone, you know, I'm really like really engaged in journaling these days. I think about my primary roles. I think about myself as a husband and as a father, especially talking to Maddie now is like a new daddy, really special time to meet a man, you know, such a transformational experience being a dad and being a partner and co-leading a family is just hugely revealing for ourselves. So I check in with myself about those things, you know, am I living up to like my values and my standards as a husband and as a parent? Yeah. And then I think about my work functioning around my clinical work. And so that's probably the hardest part for me, Maddie, right now, to be quite honest, is having a lot of really active clinical work going on, just working with a lot of individuals in psychotherapy, and then also launching a book. I haven't sort of been in this. This is my fifth book. So I've launched books before, but it always felt a little, I would say, separate. Mm-hmm. And kind of intentionally, I never wanted to be like the media doctor, like, oh, well, welcome here. Have you bought my book? It's just like, I don't know. It just I want people to be able to come and see me. And if they don't think nutritional psychiatry has any value, that I can still help them, that you don't have to kind of come into necessarily exactly my framework or my system in any way, that I really love meeting patients truly where they are. So that gets to be just, I don't know, I'm just. It's wonderful in lots of ways. I've had a couple of patients read early copies of the book, and I've had a couple of people, I don't know, it's just been really encouraging in a way that's quite meaningful. But that's, yeah, so a lot of different hats. So that's how my mental health is. Probably need a little bit more sleep, but I don't know. I decided like 3 or 4 months ago, having launched books before, and they can make you really, they can be a struggle emotionally, existentially. And I decided that I was going to model mental fitness, that I was going to try and make myself the mentally fittest version of myself for this book launch, that I would retain my poise, I would take care of my sleep, I would eat the brain foods, I would maintain my connections, I would practice self-awareness. I know my biggest challenge is about 2 months before a book, I'm like really eager working on the book after that book somehow. Like, it's like crazy making, not a good thing. So really kind of outlined all these things for myself of, as I'm here today on the verge of launch, that I'm feeling great, even though I had a horrible panicky when I have insomnia. 2 a.m. is still a rough time for me. But besides that, a little blip, I've been doing very well.
Yeah, thank you for sharing. I just didn't want to, I know, and you deal with men a lot. I think men and people in general, you know, have a tendency in conversation to either let out a little golden bit of truth and bury it in humor or bury it in other details. So I just wanted to come back in and make sure that I picked up on that.
No, I really appreciate that. I also want to give everybody the long jam version, so you see me, a real life psychiatrist, telling you and checking in about my own mental health in a, you know, somewhat structured way, because I think all of us do that. And I think it's, for me, how I weather some of those bumps, you know, and understanding that you can have both. You know, most of the time I'm doing great. I certainly have some bumps, as I think probably everybody listening does too.
Yeah, of course. It's interesting. You mentioned something in there that really resonated with me in regards to helping people, even if they don't find nutritional psychiatry interesting or applicable. And what popped up in my mind, because earlier in the piece you mentioned misinformation and sound bites. So I just want to tie those two things together because it sort of comes into an idea that I think is important, which is sort of a consequence of influencer culture. And when we've got all of these mindset gurus and health practitioners that have sort of solved their own issues and are now leading large audiences through the fire, you know, their own challenges. What I find is that the catch with that scenario is that these influencers are attracting people that have a whole spectrum of challenges. You can probably remember it. There's an effect or a syndrome that people that fall into where you've got this confirmation bias that you think because you fixed yourself, you can fix anybody with that problem. And the thing that I liked about what you said there is the reason that I went back to sort of, I did an honors in nutrition and I went back to do nutrition because I wanted to be forced to sit in front of people that didn't just like listening to this podcast, that weren't just like, I'm working with Maddie because he's a fun guy. It was like, I'm sitting in front of the family that's got three kids and finance problems and there's some abuse history and there's all of this complex stuff going on that I need to figure out. And I think that's one of the problems with this sort of influencer culture we've got is that they attract millions, but they can only help like a percentage of people that have the exact same problem and also probably a similar personality.
Yeah, well, maybe. I mean, there's the idea that if it worked for me, it's going to work for you.
Mm.
And, you know, I think there's some truth in that. And I think certainly lived experience and a lot of our kind of patient advocates have just been, you know, wonderful in terms of destigmatizing. And also we know when people kind of have peer relationships around their mental health concerns, just very helpful in terms of people's overall outcome. Because again, you don't feel alone. And, you know, there are tips and tricks that people know that sometimes doctors either don't know or forget or, you know, don't mention. So yeah, I think the influencer culture, I think the challenge with it is one, it's very important to remember the most important missing things in mental health. And I would say the top of that list is going to be proper diagnosis. And so it's easy for me to, I think, you know, as I was mentioning a panic attack, it's because I had this really powerful feeling of impending doom. And I'd not actually had that exact symptom before or identified it like that. And then I started to get a little air hunger, right? So it's kind of a very specific thing that's been sitting with me as I've been kind of wondering about that and how it fits in with how I understand myself. What happens when we kind of self-diagnose? This happens in medical school. In medical school, you get everything. Like in the 4 years of medical school, I had like cancer, diabetes, I had cancer again. You get a lot of cancer in medical school because anything that goes wrong with you, you're like, oh my gosh, because you just learned all the different types of cancer the body gets. You learn all the types of pathology. And it's a very common thing where every medical student is like, oh no, it's like, I know I've got that. It's like, oh, I know I have it too. And so, you know, what's probably helpful is if you're speaking with a real honest to goodness person who's an advocate with bipolar disorder and they're not selling you anything, but they're talking about their experience. One of those very like powerful lessons you'll learn from people with alcohol use disorder who go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and a very common notion, right? That the only way to help someone is by sharing your own story.
Mm-hmm.
That you're not ever in a group to give other people advice or to give another person a diagnosis or to tell someone what to do. You can simply share your story. Hey, what you're sharing brings this up for me. I hope that might be of use to you. And so I think the problem with influencers also is one, people believe it. You know, it doesn't take very long to be in the wellness world and to meet these folks. It's like helps breaks the spell real fast. Because you see a lot of people like maybe know one thing or have one idea, but I tend, especially with mental health, I have a little hard time trusting people who aren't clinicians.
Mm-hmm.
And because when you're a clinician, you get humbled straight up right away, day one, maybe day two, but it does not take very long. That thing that you know works, Prozac, CBT, psychodynamic psychotherapy, a little bit of this to sleep, a little bit of that. You see, it just is totally ineffective for the next person. And it just humbles you. And but I think the mix of influencer culture being that no one interprets the transference, That when you have an idealized transference, we think this kind of all-knowing, wonderful person has it figured out for us. That's generally red flags. When we're thinking about someone who has a kind of singular focus, you know, in the medical world, we call this like specialization and expertise. But in the influencer world, it gets really kind of granular, and the algorithm kind of makes it even more granular for us. And so I think that's something also to just, you know, be aware of. But yeah, it's where there's like a over-identification. And I think it makes a lot of sense because it's preying on people feeling alone, unknown, right? Your community doesn't know anything about this thing you have, maybe. And then you meet an influencer and they describe exactly what you have, and nothing feels like being known. I mean, wow, that's like, you know me, you see me. That's like good stuff. And so it's easy to pull people right in.
Do you want to know how to lose weight without counting calories or needing to use restrictive diets? Turns out the answer is on Instagram. You might be interested to know that over 70% of our paying clients begin their journey with a weight loss goal. Most of them achieve this goal without fad diets and without calorie counting. And in the process, they also rewire their brains to stop craving sugar, and they stop their secret binge eating sessions without the need to use loads of willpower. Why does what we do work? Because the fat that you want to lose, it isn't just about the calories you're consuming. It's actually wild how differently we do things. We work on your mind and your body gets better. And I think more people need to know about how we can do this for you too, which is exactly why I'm back on Instagram as The Real Weight Loss Coach. If you want to know how to really drop the weight that's been holding you down, how to keep it off, and to stay healthy long into the future, then follow me on Instagram. The link to my profile is in the show notes below, or you can search for me on Instagram by typing in The Real Weight Loss Coach. Give me a follow and I'll chat to you in the comments and the DMs over there.
Yeah, I think it's funny too, because I think a lot of people have had, especially in the mental health space, challenges with clinicians either dismissing them and their feelings and their traumas or whatever it might be, or just simply medicating them, which obviously the USA is known globally to be such a high consumer of psychiatric medications. And look, all pharmaceuticals, to be honest.
It is true. It's an interesting, I'd be curious, Maddie, your thought, because it is something that kind of defines Americans culturally.
Yeah.
So just to go over the stats, and I go over these in Healing the Modern Brain, that 1 in 4 women over the age of 60 in America takes antidepressant, usually an SSRI medication. A lot of, you know, different reasons for that. That statistic often gets pulled out as like we overprescribe. But I always like to point out that if we are going to live in an era beyond the patriarchy, that these are women, mature women, who voluntarily are taking a medicine. And usually when that happens, it's because it's helping them in some way. Most people don't want to take a psychiatric medicine. So unless it helps them, they're going to stop it. It's kind of a basic measure of something. I think oftentimes this gets portrayed as like irresponsible prescribing, and it kind of skips the step. You know, people have to fill the prescription. Like, the majority of people don't fill their prescription. So when we see such high numbers of people actually taking the medicine, I often kind of think we should step back and listen to them. And then, you know, is it simply that they're the first generation of people who've done a better job taking care of their mental health, and SSRIs are very effective? What about that idea?
I would argue my response to that would be that's one perspective, but also those people are trusting doctors. And for the most part, doctors aren't as open-minded as you, right? And you might be in a fringe of society. I mean, you created nutritional psychiatry, or you are a pioneer in that world. And most doctors will never talk to their patients about nutrition. And many doctors, Australia, USA, that are plugged into the system that they're regulated by, don't even review the drugs that they're taking. And people are often taking these drugs that are for years, years and years and years without coming back and saying, what is the root cause of the problem? Which is the conversation around maybe diet, you know, maybe the nutrition.
That's a good point. I do think that that is because other things often aren't tried first, and it's thought of as, you know, a first line. And then also, if they work or they work a little bit, people are very hesitant to stop these medications. And so I do think that's, you know, you see a lot of partial response, and then medicine adds on, and now we have a little bit more of a response, and then a third medicine is added on. So, you know, there's certainly, I think, some valid concerns about polypharmacy. And in the US, you know, if we look at, you know, there are only 40,000 psychiatrists. And there are only so many of us, of those 40,000, who are really in active daily clinical practice seeing patients. And so the majority of the medicines are written by my colleagues. And, you know, a lot of their training has been to screen for and try and diagnose depression using really short, brief screening questions to kind of be a quote-unquote frontline. And so it'll be, you know, an interesting, we're in an interesting era now as people are thinking about medicines. As again, there's a, I think, a big misinformation kind of anti-psychiatry movement around the antidepressants. And in some way, Maddie, like part of where this book came from is I found myself kind of like when I first did nutritional psychiatry, I found myself like in arguments with vegans, and it's not in any way how I wanted to be. Oh, I just didn't want to be in the world like that. Because you know, one, like I treat vegans, you know, they're like people who take some B12. Actually, you know, again, science evolves, right? We always say this, oh, as long as you take your B12, it's like, no. 2024, there's a new review, right? Finding that actually there's a number of vegans who between fortified foods and B12 analogs stay B12 replete, not eating any meat. It's like, huh? I think actually some of them are not even supplemented. It's just like, so nutrition changes. But anyway, the idea is instead of arguing about kind of antidepressant efficacy or, you know, any of this stuff, I just wanted to get to things that I saw over and over again in my practice were true. You know, things that when people engage in them and invest time, it pays a dividend. And in some ways, very simple, straightforward things like working through, you know, building more connections in your life or, you know, working on your sleep hygiene tonight. Things that I saw a lot of people, it was kind of like at their fingertips, kind of like when you, it happens a lot of times when you see a couple and they're in like horrible discord, but you get the sense of like their marriage working is like one hug away, you know, it's like really close. Like you really love each other. It seems like it's just like, you're so pissed off at one another. Just can we like, you know, it's just, it's kind of right there. So I feel for a lot of people, some of their mental health feels like that. It's like a little elusive. They used to have it, now they don't. And I wanted to give them something to focus on that again, over and over again, I see in my practice when people form relationships, when people are, you know, attentive to this relationships, you see it pay great dividends for them in terms of their mental health.
Yeah. I think maybe this is the reason I like your work, right? Is that I think that you're a little bit different to the average doctor or the average psychiatrist. And, you know, maybe some would argue that you've got the means to be able to be progressive and push the envelope. So I definitely think you're in the minority with the way that you think about how to go about healing people or fixing people.
Yeah, Maddie, you're probably right. You know, it's funny for this whole podcast, like book tour, I found myself defending my field. Like I finished podcasts. I feel like I've gone on like a rant about like how SSRIs are great. And, you know, I'm defending polypharmacy. And I'm not sure how that happens. You know, I think it's probably where I want to be responsible and authentic that, you know, I prescribe, but I appreciate what you're saying. And maybe I need to pay more attention to it. You know, that I'm maybe not the average bear in psychiatry because I kind of tend to think that I am. And yeah, I think I have a lot of respect for my colleagues and for prescribers and even, you know, all the primary care doctors are always getting in trouble because they're overprescribing. I'm just like, man, I'm proud of them for asking about mental health and I'm proud of them for like being in primary care. And so I appreciate what you're saying. I think maybe I have a real hopeful view of what psychiatry actually looks like. And I think I've also, I've trained at one of the top places in the country. My kind of cohort of psychiatrists that I know and interact and work with are just, they're top trained docs. And so maybe I have a biased view of what it looks like, but I'm very hopeful. I think modern mental health meds and all is just, it's like the best time ever in the history of humankind to have a mental health challenge, question, diagnosis, struggle. Never been a better time. We know, think about all we've learned in the last 15 years about inflammation and neuroplasticity and the microbiome and the glymphatic system, how your brain gets rid of waste. It's like, nine randomized trials now of food treating like legit mental health concerns like depression. Just, like there's so much cool evidence.
Yeah. Well, and I think as well, it's important for people like yourself, pioneers and visionaries, to have hope. Otherwise, what is the fuel that drives what you're creating and doing, right? So it's important that you have a hopeful view.
My hope is well earned, everyone, because my hope just, it comes from right where my book is dedicated. My hope is that over and over again, I see people get better. I see them get new skills, new tools. I see people adopt tenets of mental fitness. And as I said earlier, the tenets come from, you just sit with people as they're struggling with their mental health and you try some stuff and they try some stuff, you know, and then you see something work. Someone walks in and it's like, you can't miss it. It's like, oh, wow, something's like a little more affect, a little more positive, a little more spring in the step. And it's just, I don't know. It's like one of the coolest things I've ever witnessed in my life, Maddie. And it's just the most amazing thing to sit with. You see people heal. There's Norman Doidge, is a great psychiatrist's book, The Brain That Heals Itself. And that book's always really inspired on neuroplasticity, but it's always kind of inspired me as a clinician that like it's like the magical part of psychiatry. Like if you can help get things like better aligned and like kind of help a patient, you know, with the facts in front of them and the kind of cards they've been dealt and their tools kind of figure out a path through. And then you see it work. It just, I don't know. I'm a big fan of psychiatry and psychotherapy. I think they're both really, you know, underappreciated in the right hands, incredibly effective.
Yeah. Well, I want to go into that and particularly like your work with men's mental health. And I guess in some tiny way, we contribute with the podcast and the work I do into men's mental health. And we did an episode with a guy named Tony Mance just recently on episode 439 of this show. But the thing I want to ask you, Drew, is that given that we're talking about this relationship, I guess, of psychology and mindset and the way that our brain functions with nutrition and sort of mental health and diet, and knowing, I guess, that depressive or anxious moods or any of these kind of symptoms can show up and then drive us towards poor decisions about food and eating unhealthy food. I'm curious with men specifically, what have you noticed about their relationship with food or the way that they eat that differs from the way that women's relationship with food sort of shows up?
Well, I think that men are rapidly evolving their relationship with food. I mean, I think there's sort of the traditional notions like, you know, men tend to focus a little bit too much on protein, on meat, you know, these kind of stereotypical notions of men eating, you know, simple food, you know, 12-year-old boy food, pizzas, burger, fries. I'm seeing that rapidly shift. You know, the younger men that I'm treating, most of them cook. You know, if they don't cook, I kind of mention it and I don't know, like 4 days later, I get like some texts of some pictures of some like pesto and, you know, like yummy stuff that they've cooked up for themselves or their girlfriend. So I think for men, one of the challenges with nutrition is the challenge of self-care. Mm-hmm. And that men generally, you know, have been oriented to seek out, especially heterosexual men, but seek out a caregiver. And, you know, a kind of sign, a status of a success and potency is being cared for. Having your food, you know, cooked for you. And so the notion that it's very potent for a man to be organized, have their nutrition dialed in, to be able to cook and provide for your partner, to not be a, you know, needy vessel, but to be a provider in the true sense of the word. You know, that's been a real shift. I think my generation of men, I'm 50, I think probably the first where, you know, a lot of guys my age who are great cooks and really like good at taking care of themselves and really, you know, dialed in. I think, you know, if we should be realistic, it's funny to me how much there's like a focus on like medications. And it's like, man, people are really struggling with just like eating a bunch of garbage, right? What is it, like 70% of America is overweight now? Mm. Pre-diabetes is about the same rate. I mean, it's just like we're, you know, I like to be hopeful and to emphasize all of the young men who are doing a great job with nutrition. I also think that we have a beer and burger culture. We have a binge drinking culture. We have a gluttony, hedonism, flavor culture. You know, you just kind of watch the ads for the fast food where it's like, you know, you got to cram like more bacon and more beef and more cheese into whatever vessel you can and then fry it and then fry it again. And then you should put some sauce on it. And that's how you know you're a man.
And an American.
And you ate it all. And if you eat it faster than the guy next to you, you're more of a man. And so, you know, there are significant challenges. I remember this being a vegetarian, you know, definitely get teased a lot, get teased about my sexuality because I didn't eat meat. I mean, it's just, you know, it's kind of juvenile, you know, in my mind. But, you know, there's a way that I think for men listening to really get back to this initial idea that this isn't about what other people kind of think of you, or this is really about your caring for yourself. And if you are a man who goes through periods of like not eating very much or isolating, a lot of my patients are like this. They just, especially like after a breakup, they just like don't eat very much. You know, when they do, it's just unintentional. It's like self-harm. You know, it's just like a pizza really fast and a six pack. It's not like, hey, you need to take care of yourself better than anyone has ever taken care of you. You know, buy the good food, make it for yourself. It's a big part of healing for a lot of men. And then I think also the cooking, you know, like I find a lot of men are really, it's one of the advantages of being a clinician is you get to talk to women, but you're like in a different role than other men in their life. So they like tell you the real stuff. It's called they spill the tea, but you know, it's sort of wonderful because you hear much more about like men and what it's like for them to be dating men often. And, you know, you hear like this regular report of like, yeah, I know, it's like, didn't ask me any questions about me, you know, sort of bad table manners. You just kind of see this like kind of regressed male attitude sometimes that, again, the notion of caring for yourself, right? And then being able to provide for other people is like a natural sequence of masculine evolution and maturation. And that first step, the care of the self, being able to kind of feed and water yourself and care for your own emotions in a responsible way. I just think that's been missing for a lot of men.
Yeah, and I'm excited, and I maybe would include myself in this little group of people, but the sort of maybe resurgence of some traditional masculinity in regards to being a provider and looking after yourself and being big and strong and dangerous. And I think Jordan Peterson's been a big part of contributing to that idea that it's, you know, it's better to be a warrior in a garden than, you know, a gardener in a war kind of thing, and that and all the ideals that sort of comes with. And I know for myself going on my own psychotherapy, psychology, trauma healing journey that I felt that society as a whole and maybe the feminist movement and the anti-patriarchy movement made me feel like I needed to be a lot more feminized in order to be not dangerous and accepted and safe and all of that kind of thing. And it was really useful because that chapter of my life allowed me to develop a lot of emotional intelligence and connection with deeper parts of myself. But I found that on the other side of that, with this sort of, yeah, this resurrection maybe, or this evolution of sort of traditional values a little bit more, and that it's okay to be a man and aggression is useful in the right context, and all of these feelings are useful and helpful in the right context. And in fact, a lot of women like and are attracted to that. It actually made me feel much more empowered to be like, oh, it's okay to be a man and to express manly desires and needs, and to, you know, sometimes it is super nice to have your dinner cooked for you. I'm totally able to cook and provide for everybody. I'm doing a lot of that right now. But it's just this interesting idea that I felt that in order to be safe, I guess, as a man, and to be able to express any of that stuff, that I had to be more feminine.
You know, my perspective on this has just been so shaped by my wife, who is like the most ardent feminist that you'll meet, but also really like loves to call me her big, strong man. I feel so, I think blessed is the word, to kind of be able to experience both have all those things that need to be challenged about traditional masculinity get challenged. You know, I mean, I'm all for some of the idea that there are masculine attributes, kind of. I think there's a lot of this talk that's just talk, you know, a lot of the most potent, most, you know, kind of strongest, most boundaried, most speaking up people I know in my community are the women. Mm-hmm. And I find where masculinity, this resurgence hasn't really done a very good job in some ways is pointing out some of the problems that just solely men are responsible for. You know, the violent crime and rape in our world is at the hands of men. And so, you know, I think men feeling that they can be contributors, men understanding that masculine energy is about setting boundaries, men understanding that strength comes from listening and understanding and building empathy. Like, it'll be interesting to see if it kind of bends that way. I think right now there's a lot of noise and a lot of chainsaws by people who've never cut down a tree with a chainsaw. And I think that's starting to bother me, Maddie, because I'm a guy who's cut down a tree with a chainsaw, and I have a lot of respect for a chainsaw. That's one of those things. Actually, my mom didn't let me get one until later in life. We moved back to my farm when I was in my 40s. I bought myself my first chainsaw. Incredibly powerful feeling if you never used a chainsaw, the amount of work you can do. But you also have this sense that you're just constantly next to a level of danger and force and destructive power that's kind of like unlike anything you've ever held in your hand. So, yeah, sometimes I just think there's a lot of saber rattling about like masculinity. And it's like, I don't know, like pretty much continually the strongest, best community members I'm seeing are often the women. And so,
yeah, I really like how you just phrased that, because I feel the same about what you're saying with masculinity. And there's a lot of people shouting at rooftops that have never actually gone out there and applied or tried to do any of these things. And I feel the same being a nutritionist when it comes to vegans in their ivory towers in cities that have never actually been to a farm or spoken to a farmer. You know, I feel like it's the same idea. It's people that receiving information from social media, these highly curated algorithms that are sending them specific content, and they're forming opinions, whether they're aware of it or not, and then regurgitating that opinion back. And it's like, yeah, they need to cut down a tree.
I think it's, you know, there are a lot of skills I think most men, myself included, need to learn as we evolve as men. I think there's a lot of focus, misplaced focus on, you know, men finding their passion in their 20s and that like guiding them for the rest of their life. And that's just a horrible roadmap for a man. Absolutely horrible and very ineffective. And yeah, I think that, you know, for both young men and young women, I hope things settle down. I mean, part of the challenge that we're having right now in America is that there's so much distraction that it's really impossible for people to focus on everyday progress. You know, everyday progress is studying. Everyday progress is like today. I traveled from New York here to Bermuda, where I've got this like amazing male mental health weekend planned with Men's Health magazine. And I got to my hotel room, I got to work. I took care of my patients. There's something about focusing on the day-to-day, about honing your craft, whatever work or profession you're in, about building your community that's getting lost right now in the political chaos. So I hope we get back to the important business of hand.
Yeah, I totally agree. Well, and I guess off the back of speaking about men's mental health and getting back to business at hand, I've heard you talk about the fact that, I guess, violent behavior in prisons was improved when these prisons started focusing on brain-focused nutrition. Can you tell us more about that? Because I think that's a really useful physical example of how transformational the nutrition can be on our brains.
Yeah, there's a little bit of research around, I think, a study with micronutrient supplementation. And then I think there's some small studies on diet. It's not a literature I know incredibly well. But I think the basic idea is that when you have malnourished individuals or undernourished individuals, they're going to be more prone to acts of aggression, just like they're going to have an increased risk of depression. And so when you're dealing with an incarcerated population, you know, and you're trying to rehabilitate some of them to help them get back to society, you know, there's probably a set of skills that's really important that they learn. And there's probably a set of nutrients that are very important for them to consume. And so, you know, I think about it very much like I think about school food. You know, it's not prison, but you have our nation's youth in school. You're feeding them lunch. Are you feeding them foods that promote brain health, decrease their risk of depression, decrease their risk of ADHD, improve their ability to focus in the afternoon? Or are you feeding them the cheapest food that you can? And unfortunately, over and over again, the U.S. government has made the decision to feed the future brains of America the cheapest food possible.
Yeah,
so, it's, you know, it's our prisoners, but it also quickly, to me, just translates to our kids. And, you know, and some of the cool things that have been happening. There's been a really fun farm to table movement in America that also then extended to like a farm to school movement. A lot of that funding I've heard is just getting cut. So that said, One of the great things about our communities in America is it's filled with lots and lots of really active, potent men and women on all sides of the political spectrum who, for the most part, agree that we should feed our kids healthy foods. So they might get into a debate on how much meat that should include. But, you know, I hope Healing the Modern Brain kind of asks people, I wouldn't say to cut through some of this, but to settle down into caring for themselves. And then by extension, using that kind of mentally fit self to engage in and build better communities.
Yeah, fantastic. So for everybody that's interested in, I guess, what you've got to say, your work, nutritional psychiatry, and your books, where can everybody find you online? Where can they get more of you?
Well, Maddie, thanks. I feel everybody, you just got a big earful of me. So I'd love you to check out the book, Healing the Modern Brain. It's also an e-course. Everything is Drew Ramsey, MD. DrewRamseyMD.com is my website. DrewRamseyMD, that's my Instagram and Facebook page. The most recent book, Healing the Modern Brain, 9 Tenets to Build Mental Fitness and Revitalize Your Mind, is in bookstores everywhere. I'd love you to check out the book. And if you like it, I'd really appreciate a 5-star review wherever you buy books. And I've got a podcast. We just finished up our first season. So if you get tired of Maddie, you know, I'm probably not quite as much fun. My accent's not as good, but I'm happy to share some really fun experts. And yeah, Maddie, I really appreciate the time and attention. Let me air out some of these fun subjects about mental health and medications and mental fitness. It's great to talk with you.
Yeah, likewise. It's been fantastic. And I appreciate your vulnerability and just talking through some of these ideas, which is nice. But before we finished, what is one piece of health information you wish more people knew about?
I wish more people knew about their mental health. I wish more people knew about modern mental health, meaning that you spend some time learning about your brain and your mental health. You spend some time learning about what modern mental health treatments actually look like. You confront some of your own biases about mental health. The thing that I find frustrating and where Healing the Modern Brain really comes from is that, you know, everybody listening knows a bunch of different ways to take care of their physical health. Right? If you're not in shape, but you had to get in shape in 30 days, the world would end. You'd know what to do. You'd run, you'd lift, you'd do push-ups, jumping jacks. Right? But when it comes to our mental health, I just found that it feels more elusive to people. Even the nutrition piece, you tell people like, oh, food matters for your mental health. It's like, wow, really? And it's just, and really educated folks just haven't gotten this memo. And so, you know, I hope people with this book and also this podcast episode hear my hopefulness. And again, not, this isn't a bunch of strange supplements or, you know, weird cold plunge and sauna rituals you need to do. This is very straightforward, science supported, clinically supported framework of how you can better grow your mental health and build your mental fitness. So that's what I want people to know, Maddie, is you can do it. It's possible.
Amazing. Thanks for being here, Drew. I'm looking forward to chatting again soon in the future.
Thank you, Maddie. And congratulations on being a daddy. I can't wait to talk to you in the future, see how it's settling in with you. I don't think anything is going to make you a better podcaster, a better man, a better person, better clinician than that process. So good luck with it all. Congratulations.
Yeah, I'm excited to go on this journey. Thank you. Hey, thanks for listening to the show. If you enjoyed this episode or learnt anything at all, the gift of your 5-star rating would be incredibly helpful. And what's even more powerful is if you write a review. You can do it below each episode on Spotify, every time an episode comes out, and inside Apple Podcast, simply find the main page of this show with all the episodes on it, scroll to the bottom, hit write a review, share your amazing feedback, and then hit send. It helps this show grow tremendously and allows me to successfully invite bigger and more famous guests each time we do the show. Thank you, thank you, thank you for helping us climb the charts, climb the algorithm, and help more people. Oh, and by the way, I have a short disclaimer as well. I just wanted to quickly remind you that the information provided on this podcast is for general informational purposes only. While we strive to bring you accurate and up-to-date content, it's important to note that a lot of this is mixed with opinions, stories, and ideas not supported by mainstream science or medicine. Any advice or suggestions should not be considered a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always consult a healthcare provider before making any decisions about the health and wellness of you and your family. Remember too that what works for one person may not work for another. another. And just as we promote on the show, each person is responsible for their own health decisions. Thank you for tuning into the How to Not Get Sick and Die podcast. And now, the next episode. Here it is.